16. Mark was propelled up from the chair by a burst of directionless fury. Frustration crowded in on him, and he snatched up the wireless keyboard from in front of the monitor. Every last impulse in him wanted to smash it against the desk. In that second, all he wanted to do was break something. It had been a waste. Everything he had done. His elaborate ruse to gain access to the embassy, getting himself in a room with John Farrier so he could use his old friend's passcodes, all for nothing. His prize was gone, his targets one step ahead of him, just as they had been in Dunkirk and every day since. Fuck! He let the keyboard drop and stood there, every muscle in his body tense with rage. He could almost hear the sound of his luck running out, like some far-off crash of thunder rolling down the hills toward him. And then, as if fate was playing a joke at his expense, a single string of text in green appeared among the endless stream of dull red failed fields. Two words. File found. Like a drowning man grabbing at a rope, Mark snatched back the keyboard, and his fingers scrambled across the buttons in a clattering rush. "What is it?" said Farrier, frowning at the lines of impenetrable code. "A temp file." The words spilled out of Mark's mouth. He was almost giddy, snapped back from the bitter edge of failure in a heartbeat, desperate to see what single piece of data his search had recovered. "Is something stored on the MI6 comm server while being moved from one stack to another?" He had to stop typing and physically force himself to take a calming breath. What lay before him was the ghost of a file, a fragment of digital chaff caught in the cogs of the electronic communications system. Whoever had gone through the server at Vauxhall Cross had been very thorough, but they had missed this one record because it was in the wrong place. It's like you scrunch up a bit of paper and toss it in the rubbish, only you miss, and it falls between the bin and the wall. You don't find it for weeks. Mark swallowed, aware that he was talking without thinking. It's an image. Can we see it? Very carefully, Mark sent a copy to the laptop. Then, to make doubly certain, he added a macro to send another out via email to the dozen anonymous file-sharing databanks he used. Inside the shielded walls of the embassy building, the laptop's Wi-Fi wouldn't be able to accomplish that. But the moment Mark was outside, it would zap off into the cloud, replicating itself in blind servers all over the globe. The picture unfolded on the bigger monitor, a complex swirl of dull, earthy colours, hauled like a fractal and dappled by shadows. "Satellite imagery," offered Farrier. "Russian source, judging by that." He pointed at a Cyrillic digital watermark at the bottom of the shot. "Desert, mountain, foothills." He scanned the screen with a practiced eye. "What have we got here?" Appended to the picture were notations in a language Mark didn't immediately recognize. "That's Turkish," Farrier went on. He leaned in to read. "And this is Turkey. There's map coordinates here, somewhere near the northwestern border of Kahramanmaras province." Off Mark's questioning look, he gave a shrug. "I had some work there a while back." Mark knew better than to ask for more details. He pointed at a cluster of buildings at the foot of a hillside. "This looks like a compound of some kind." He wondered why the MI6 mole thought this image was important enough to email it to Novakovich. "Not a military site, though," said Farrier. He tapped the screen, indicating two words. "Yeni Gun." "New Day," he translated. "I know the name. It's a charity group for kids in that region. Waifs and strays, war orphans, all that." "They're just kids." Farrier's words sparked a flash of recall in Mark's mind. For a second he could smell burnt metal and hear Gavin Rix's voice in his ear as it crackled over the secure radio link. The memory made his skin crawl and he frowned. Was there a connection? Or was he just forcing two disparate pieces of data together to create a correlation that didn't exist? It wasn't something Mark had time to dwell on. Lane and the rest of the embassy security team were on their way by now, and every second he spent considering the fractional sliver of intelligence he had recovered was a second less he could spend making his next move. "Whatever the hell that is going to be," he said to himself. Mark pulled the cables on the laptop, erasing the search program but leaving the secure terminal open. "I've got to go," he said. "Thanks again." "I can't cover for you this time," Faria told him, his eyes solemn. "You can't come to me again, Mark. It's too risky for both of us." "I know," Mark said, cutting him off. "And I'm sorry too, mate." Without warning, he brought up the Glock and used the butt of the gun to club his friend across the temple. Faria went down in a heap, dazed and bleeding. He flinched at the violence of the act, but it was necessary if he was to keep Faria blameless. The twist in his gut still felt like betrayal, though. Mark ignored it and slipped out of the office, sprinting away down the narrow corridor. The embassy's first-floor windows were designed to trap the shade of the day and keep the offices cool. Security concerns meant that from the outside, they were almost impossible to open, but from within, it was a different story. Mark would have liked the opportunity for a subtle approach, but that wasn't to be. His mind kept spooling back to a single, toxic dread. He had no plan for this. The way he wanted it to play out, the way it should have. He would find the files he wanted, then offer a surrender, secure in the knowledge that he had the proof he needed to clear his name. He cursed himself now for being naive, foolish enough to think that things might actually go his way this time. Off the administration wing, there was a room with a window that peered out over the ornamental pond at ground level. Mark loaded a trolley with cartons of copy paper, turning it into a makeshift battering ram. He shouldered it into the window with a crack that popped the seams around the toughened safety glass. On the second attempt, the window yawned open wide enough for him to scramble out with the day pack secure on his back. From a distance, it hadn't seemed so high, but now as he contemplated the fall, Mark realized that there was enough of a drop from the first floor to the shallow pond to break his bones. He took it anyway, lowering himself as much as he could before letting go. He cut the water with a hissing splash and hit the concrete bed beneath, hard enough that lines of fire shot up his legs and shocked his spine. Soaking the stolen Armani suit, he ran across the width of the pond, dodging around the spray from the fountains. The white glare of torch beams bobbed among the embassy's pillars, crisscrossing as they searched for him. He glimpsed figures carrying the spindly shapes of Heckler & Koch MP5 SD3 submachine guns. Mark had fired those during training, the snapping sound of the discharge reminding him of the pop of Christmas crackers. The weapons were discreet enough that the sound would be swallowed by the steady hum of the traffic out on the Viale del Moro Toto. He moved into the wooded area of the embassy garden, staying low. There was little doubt that any capture orders on him would now be shoot on sight as a matter of course. "Escape and evade," he told himself. Easier said than done. The day pack bounced as he moved, staying in the shadows. He threw a glance back toward the main entrance, where he had driven in with Torrance's Ferrari. Blue strobe lights shimmered on the other side of the big gates. An Alfa Romeo from the Polizia parked nose to nose with a fire tender from the Vigili del Fuoco. Even if he could cross the open ground between here and there, the guards on duty would catch him well before he had a chance to step off British territory and back into Italian jurisdiction. He did what was least expected of him, and the most risky. Mark turned back toward the main building and headed toward the far side of the compound. There was a service entrance over there for delivery vans and maintenance vehicles. As he moved, under the noise of the traffic and the steady bleating of the fire alarms, a low-pitched buzz caught the edge of Mark's hearing and he reflexively looked up. But then it was gone and he shook off the distraction. He moved around a skinny cypress tree behind a leafy bush on a rise overlooking the service gate. The secondary entrance opened out onto the Via Palestro. And while the big metal gates had been partially drawn open, the retractable bollards blocking access to the road were still up. Mark's hopes withered as he counted six armed figures forming a cordon around the gate. He caught sight of Lane, her pistol still drawn, in conversation with one of the guards. He couldn't make out what she was saying, but Lane's body language was more than enough to convey her ferocity. "Not that way, then," he whispered, drawing back into the shadows. Mark was about to turn away when he glimpsed a slow, black shape through the open gate as it passed by. A Toyota RAV4, identical to the vehicle that Mark had seen in his rearview mirror on the way from the St. Regis, crawled by at a steady, deliberate pace before disappearing behind the wall. He wanted to tell himself that there was no way it could be the same vehicle, but the shape of the SUV and the tinted windows were identical. Mark moved back through the trees, paralleling the path of the side road. If the SUV was something, if it wasn't MI6. The buzzing noise interrupted his train of thought, and this time he was certain he had heard it. Mark aimed his pistol in the direction of the sound and saw a blur of motion, a spindly shape like two joined figure eights clustered around a spherical pod. The little drone flyer hovered a few meters over his head, bobbing in the light breeze, and he drew a bead on it. Wherever the thing had come from, it sure as hell wasn't Foreign Office issue. And if it was feeding images of him back to embassy security, he would never have heard the bullets that would have taken him down. Mark hesitated to fire at it, knowing that a gunshot would announce his location to everyone in the compound. Slowly the drone dropped down to head height. Then, with little flicks of motion, it buzzed toward the wall, stopping to wait for Mark to follow it. "What's that, boy?" he asked, as if he was talking to a dog. "What have you got for me, huh?" The entire thing seemed surreal, and it was almost enough to make him burst out laughing. He was close to the sheer grey expanse of the embassy wall when the drone suddenly zipped up into the air and over the coils of razor wire at the top. A second later, Mark heard a hollow cough of compressed air, and a black nylon cord came streaming back over the wall, trailing from a grapnel head. It landed at his feet, an open invitation. Mark threw a last look over his shoulder in the direction of the embassy and holstered the Glock before snatching up the cord. He tugged it twice and got an answering pull in return. He barely had time to brace himself before the line went taut and he was yanked up off his feet. For one worrying moment, Mark feared he would be dragged through the sharp tines of the razor wire, but his ascent halted just short of the top of the wall, allowing him to gingerly negotiate the coils. From the far side, he could hear angry voices and see the flicker of torchlight reflected off the tree canopy. Discarding the cord, he gathered himself as a door opened on the side of the SUV, idling at the curb. An athletic black woman with short hair and a wry curl to her mouth looked out at him. "Hey," she said by way of a greeting. Over her shoulder, Mark saw what looked like a mil-spec equipment case packed with low-light video screens and control boards. "Hey," he replied because he didn't have a better response. "So I guess you need a lift." Her accent was East Coast American, confident with it. She beckoned him with her index finger. "Come on." Mark made the snap decision and vaulted into the vehicle, hearing the wheels hiss against the asphalt as the Toyota bolted away and into a slewing turn that threw it down a narrow side street. He rolled with the motion and bounced onto a seat, struggling to keep his balance. Behind the woman, he caught a glimpse of sandy hair and a sallow face, but little more of the vehicle's silent driver. The woman showed Mark a smile. "So this makes it twice I saved your ass," she told him. "Twice," he echoed, even as one of Farrier's questions came flashing back to him. "Who was the sniper in Woolworth?" "You don't have to thank me," she added, pulling something from the folds of her jacket. More police strobes flashed past as they turned onto the main boulevard, and Mark shot a worried glance out of the window. "Where are we going?" When he looked back, she had one of those dart guns in her hand, the kind that zookeepers in wildlife documentaries use to drug tigers. "Out," she told him, and the pistol chugged. Mark saw a fast blur, as if a giant bee had thrown itself at his neck and stung him. He slapped at the pain as a wash of cold went through his veins, and his hand came away with a little blood on it, a feathered dart falling from his numbing fingers. He tried to talk, but his lips and tongue had suddenly turned into lifeless meat. The inside of the SUV spun around him, and warm darkness rose up to smother him. The wind off the ocean rolled up over the decks of the Santa Cruz, plucking at the places where tarps had not been firmly tied down. Emerging from out of the threatening cloud, the helicopter seemed to approach in total silence, all sound of its rotors stolen away by the stiff breeze. It passed up the length of the freighter and turned around. The loud clatter of the aircraft came from nowhere, and the wedge-shaped fuselage of the German-made MBB BK-117 dropped toward the deck of the ship. The loading hatch over the Santa Cruz's main cargo bay had been reinforced to act as a helipad, and the pilot lined up the skids for a careful touchdown. Two men watched the helicopter's arrival, the Serb with the eternally disdainful expression, and the grimacing Englishman, who glared into the fading light of the day. The BK-117 landed with a heavy thud, and the rotors were barely spooling down as the Serb barked out orders to a pair of crewmen, sending them up to secure the helicopter against the deck. Three figures climbed out of the aircraft, one less than they were supposed to be. The Englishman wasted no time, shooting a look at the man who had piloted them to the ship. "You Grunwald?" The man shook his head. "Ellis," he said in a dry growl, jerking a thumb at his chest. He indicated to the two others with him, one with a blank, hollow-eyed countenance, and another with a sardonic, measuring gaze. "That's Tiep, and the posh one, he's Grunwald." "You're a new man," said the Swiss mercenary. "Please to..." He was cut off before he could continue. "They said there were four of you coming. Where's the other one? What's his name? Cruz?" "Ah," said Grunwald. "Let's just say his contract came to an unexpected conclusion." "Silly bastard fell into a volcano," offered Ellis. "You what?" The Englishman's face soured. "Are you taking a piss?" "It's not as dramatic as it sounds," Grunwald replied, stepping down onto the weather deck. "Your boy Dane has quite a survival instinct."
"He ain't my boy," came the reply.
"As you wish," Grunwald shrugged. "But I'll say this for him. He's tenacious."
"What the fuck?"
The other man shook his head in disbelief.
"Shit. I've got here just in time, because obviously you lads don't even know how to deal with one slippery little prick."
He advanced on Grunwald. "Listen, I don't know what the SOP was before, but now I'm on side, there will be zero screw-ups. You read me?"
"You got a lot of mouth on you," Ellis said, his eyes narrowing. "Who the hell are you again?"
"Who am I?"
The Englishman's fist came up in a blur and struck Ellis in the throat, not enough to do any real damage, but enough to make him choke and stagger back against the lip of the cargo hatch.
"I'm Tommy fucking Atkins, pal. I'm the one running you now, so less of the lip."
Ellis reeled and stopped himself on the verge of trying something in return. The other man looked back at Grunwald.
"So, what's that? Two dead now? He's doing better than you."
"It's not all bad," insisted the mercenary. "We leveraged the family to recover the hard drive from the yacht."
"It's intact," said Teep. "I checked."
"So push that then."
Grunwald shook his head.
"Dane's sister is under police protection. We can't get near them."
The Englishman spat on the deck.
"Bollocks."
The mercenary had the good grace to look contrite.
"Faso delivered the drive to the courier as ordered, but I think we need to go up the line."
That earned him a challenging glare.
"Oh, yeah?
You want to talk to the men in charge?"
He shook his head. "That's not your call to make."
"I know they are not pleased," insisted Grunwald. "We have a lot of loose ends here. And I know there's been talk about going dark until the Dane issue is dealt with."
"Yeah. Well, that ain't going to wash with Saladin and his fucking children's crusade."
He stopped as two figures approached from the stern, hunched forward against the wind.
"Speak of the devil."
Kadir advanced, his face as stormy as the clouds. Jadid hovered close to his side, his gaze in constant motion back and forth between the mercenaries.
"Why was I not told a helicopter was meeting us?" demanded Kadir. "Who are these men?"
"Consultants," said the Englishman.
"This is our operation," Kadir insisted, bristling at his tone. "The Combine involved you in order to assist us."
"And that's what we're doing," replied Tommy.
He looked back at Grunwald. "Tell me you got one thing right, at least. Did you bring him his toys?" The mercenary gave Teep a nod, and the dour American went to the rear of the helicopter. He opened the curved cowling around the BK-117's cargo compartment and removed a pair of long, slab-like containers. Kadir jerked his chin, and Jadid stepped up to assist him.
"Open them," he commanded.
Teep gave Grunwald a questioning look, but the other man waved him away.
"He bought them. Let him see them."
"Al-Saif bought these weapons," Kadir corrected.
Jadid produced a lock knife and used it to slice open lines of bright red security tape around the latches. Cracking the seal, Jadid gave a grunt of approval as the contents were revealed. Each container held a trio of narrow white tubes just under 3 meters in length, terminating in bright red caps and festooned with safety pins and warning tapes. Fins sprouted from the rear and the front of the tubes, and down the length of their bodies were lines of component numbers.
"From Hanzhong, Nanfeng, via Pyongyang, to you," said Grunwald with a smirk. "The PILI-5, short-range air-to-air missile. Accept no substitutes."
"Happy now?" Tommy demanded. Kadir met his gaze.
"And what of the other issues you spoke of?"
"That's a work in progress," offered Grunwald. "He got away from us in Sicily and resurfaced in Rome, but British intelligence lost track of him there."
"Fucking morons,"
snapped the Englishman, and his use of foul language made both Kadir and Jadid glare at him with open disdain. He didn't appear to notice, gesturing at Grunwald.
"They're worse than you are. Can't find their asses with a torch and a roadmap."
He shook his head.
"Doesn't matter. The Combine have a contingency in place. Dane thinks he's clever, so we let him be clever. We're going to kill two birds with one stone. We set out a box, we just have to put him in it."
At first, Mark thought he was drowning. And it was that hot flash of naked panic that kicked him back up above the surface of the chemical sleep dragging on him. He struggled against the pull of waves that wrapped themselves around him, catching him in a net he could not escape from. Mark remembered the impact as the Lynx collided with the white caps off Truro Shoal, the cold waters of the South China Sea filling the helicopter's cockpit and battering him back against his seat. He remembered it as if it were happening now, only this time he wasn't getting out. This time he was going to follow the crashed aircraft down into the deeps along with the rest of his crew. And then he was kicking, weakly, at a snarl of fine cotton bedsheets, sliding against his own clammy skin. Mark rolled back and saw a curved arc of ceiling lit by soft lamps. His head felt thick and heavy, and it made it hard for him to think straight. Everything seemed to have an unreal, dreamlike quality.
"What was in that dart?"
he said aloud, croaking the question through an arid mouth. Mark's hand went to his throat where the needle had gone in, and there was the raised dot of a fresh scab there. As he climbed from the embrace of the bed, Mark was rewarded by a thudding headache that emerged from the depths of his skull and set up residence right between his eyes. Blinking, he surveyed his surroundings. He appeared to be in a small, oddly shaped but very well-appointed hotel room with no windows. The air tasted dry, and even draining the water glass he found on the bedside table didn't lessen that. There was a vibration underlying everything that put him off balance, but Mark couldn't tell if that was real or just some strange artifact of the drugs working themselves out of his system. A set of clothes, an expensive Nike tracksuit and matching trainers had been left out for him, and he dressed as quickly as he could. Of the suit he had stolen from Callum Torrance, the day pack, the Glock pistol and his laptop, there was no sign. Mark tried the door handle, expecting it to be locked. The fact that it wasn't caught him off guard. Stepping out of the room, he found himself in a thin corridor, and suddenly the reason for the unusual dimensions of the hotel room became clear. The curve of the ceiling over his head, the steady vibration, the narrow confines. He was on board a wide-body airliner, one that was clearly designed around the needs of some very well-heeled passengers. Mark crossed to a window and peered out. He saw the arc of a wing and an engine in the spill of illumination from the cabin, the pulse of a running light flashing steadily. He guessed that the jet was at cruising altitude, but in the darkness it was hard to be certain. After a moment, he gave up looking for landmarks and used the visible stars to figure a rough directional fix. They were flying east. He wondered about what that could mean and turned away. Across the cabin there was a man of average build and pale skin, his hair hidden under a watch cap. He gave Mark an even look, showing no sign of alarm at finding him up and around. Then, almost carelessly, he jerked a thumb at a door leading toward the aircraft's forward compartments. Without a word, he walked away, down the corridor Mark had emerged into, and disappeared through a door to another cabin. In its own way, Mark reflected, that was almost insulting. The pale man, Mark was pretty sure it was the same one who had been driving the RAV4 in Rome, considered him so little a threat that he didn't call for help or otherwise raise the alarm. Scowling at the thought, he went through the next door, revealing a large conference room that filled the width of the aircraft. On one wall was an oil painting of the African veldt, and Mark's eyes were drawn to glassy plates in the surface of the table that dominated the room. He guessed that there were projectors, screens, and other digital tech embedded in the rich wood. Like everything else on the plane, it was a bespoke setup. The next compartment was a lounge area with a curved bar made of glass, dark red leather, and brushed steel. Seated by a window, the woman who had drugged him looked up from the pages of a glossy French fashion magazine. "Enjoy your nap." Mark held up his hands. "I really don't want you to shoot me again." She cocked her head. "I really don't want you to give me a reason to." His frown deepened, and he went to the bar, helping himself to a bottle of mineral water, draining it halfway in a single pull. "What am I doing here? Maybe I should start with that." His eyes flicked around the small sink behind the bar. There was a sharp cocktail knife for cutting limes within arm's reach. He thought about palming it. "You're being kept alive," she replied. "All part of the service." He didn't like the way that came out. But before Mark could question her further, two men approached from the corridor leading to the jetliner's nose. Both well-dressed, one of them slender with a Gallic face, the other tall, dark and imposing, a serious cast to his expression. He surveyed Mark with a measuring look, taking him in with a nod.
"Mr. Dane," he said. "I am Echo Solomon. Please accept my apologies for the manner in which you were brought here. I hope you understand it was the most expedient choice under the circumstances."
"Right. Of course." Mark met the man's gaze and found what seemed like honesty looking back at him.
"You've already met my driver, Malt, and Miss Keys." He nodded toward the woman.
"Call me Lucy," she smiled.
Solomon indicated the man at his side. "This is Henry Delancourt, my executive assistant."
Delancourt inclined his head.
"Bonjour."
He showed a brief, practiced smile that didn't reach his eyes.
"I apologize about the clothes. Your suit was quite soiled by your escape."
"It was on loan anyway," Mark replied.
"Where's my gear?" "Your computer is safe," Solomon explained. "I hope you'll understand that I had Henry examine it."
"Custom encryption, very good," said the other man.
"Not standard MI6 issue."
"I don't work for Six," Mark corrected.
"Not anymore."
He carefully put down the bottle.
"Look, if you're after Novakovich's drive, I don't have it. The Swiss guy took it."
Solomon sighed and took a seat.
"Mr. Dane, I think you may be operating under a mistaken assumption."
Mark listened as he spoke, trying to place the man's accent. East Africa, at a guess, perhaps Kenyan. It was hard to be certain.
"My people have been tracking you since you walked into Vauxhall Cross. I have been very eager to have a conversation with you. What I want is to hear your side of the story."
Mark said nothing for several moments, turning the man's words over in his thoughts.
"I know your name," he said at length.
"You're the founder of the Rubicon Group, bit of a mystery man, someone who likes to keep himself off the stage."
"That is so," Solomon allowed. "I prefer my anonymity."
"I also know that your company has a small division that's active in the field of private military contracting. Rubicon, like any number of other PMCs working in the global theatre, were monitored as best they could be by British intelligence. K-Section back in London were peripherally aware of Rubicon's involvement in kidnap and recovery operations in Chad and Bolivia. Work on close protection details in Iraq and China. But that was their above-board stuff. There were rumours that Rubicon had a hand in a number of less-than-legal incidents as well. But, as with most ghost stories in the spec ops community, actual details were sketchy. Mark said as much to Solomon, watching the man for any reaction. "There's a good reason for that," said Lucy, answering for him. "We work very hard at staying off the radar, and my boss here is pretty wealthy."
"We don't fight wars for people, Mr. Dane," said Solomon. "The majority of the operations my employees take on are subsidized by Rubicon itself, not those whom we assist. I have a different take on what soldiers without flags can accomplish for the world. Do you follow me?"
"Not really. And to be honest, corporate mercenaries don't have the best reputation these days." Mark saw a glitter of silver as Solomon leaned forward, a thin chain showing against his throat through the open collar of a sea-blue silk shirt. There was something hanging at the end of the chain, but he couldn't quite make it out, some abstract piece of curved metal.
"That is so," Solomon went on. "But let me offer you a simple truth as a counter. It is a regrettable fact that no government can ever be fully trusted to make the truly right choice when confronted by an impossible situation. People elect their leaders in the hope that they are moral souls, but no one is perfect. Inevitably, men are loyal in one of only two ways. They are loyal to their nation, even if that nation is misguided or wrong, or they are loyal to avarice and greed, interested only in power and wealth. They do what they will to serve one of those masters."
He brought his hands together. "When the time comes to make a moral choice between right and wrong, few can faithfully follow that path to the end. Men will do what is right for them, not what is right." Mark shifted uncomfortably. He didn't know where this conversation was heading, but he didn't like the tone of it. He couldn't be certain if Solomon was trying to convince him or threaten him.
"I built Rubicon from ashes," said the other man. "Ashes of war. I have worked hard to raise myself up from the poverty I was born into. Believe me when I tell you I have seen every kind of injustice all across the heartland of my mother Africa. And now, I have made billions of dollars from land and mining and technology. Now, I can do something about it. As Lucy says, I am a very rich man."
He reached up to his neck and pulled out the silver chain between his fingers.
"I see you looking at this. Do you recognize it?"
Mark gave a slow nod. Now it was clear to him. He could see that the odd bit of discolored metal was actually part of a weapon. It was the trigger from an AK-47 assault rifle.
"This is a reminder of the reasons I built Rubicon," Solomon told him. "I did it with one thought in mind, to serve no nation but justice."
The other man's words didn't sit well with him, and Mark couldn't stop himself from showing doubt on his face. "So, you're telling me that you founded a PMC force to act as what? Vigilantes on a global scale?" "That's one way of looking at it, I suppose," said Delancourt. "But Mr. Solomon prefers to consider the group's work as a force for good."
"And what gives you the right to do that?"
Mark studied Solomon, his own circumstances forgotten for the moment. "What makes it okay for you to take the law into your own hands?"
"Many nation states have done that in the past. Your own Great Britain once did so. But it is not about power, Mr. Dane. It is about responsibility. In a lawful, moral society, it is the responsibility of the rich man to see that the poor man does not starve. It is the responsibility of the strong man to see that the weak man is not preyed upon."
Solomon stood up again. "Once a man has power, as I do, he has a moral imperative to use it for the betterment of the world." "That's a very laudable goal," Mark replied after a moment. "How exactly do I figure into it?"
"You put your foot in something nasty, and some of it has stuck to you," said Lucy. the Combine. She said the name, and Mark couldn't help but grimace. Rubicon had been tracking their network for a while now. We think your people at MI6 got caught up in something they are planning, and, she trailed off. It hasn't gone well. Mark felt an irrational flash of annoyance at the woman's words, but he pushed the emotion away. I may be on the run from my own countrymen, but if you think I'm going to compromise MI6, you're way off base. That's not it at all, insisted Delancourt. After we learned that you fled, we deduced that you would most likely come to Rome looking for John Farrier. You trained with him. We? You trust him. We are trying to do the same thing you are, said Solomon. I want to find the members of this group and expose them. They are anathema to Rubicon and its ideals. The Combine exists solely to supply weapons and support to terrorist groups around the world, to maintain a state of global instability and gain wealth by abusing that imbalance. He hesitated, glancing at Lucy. A silent communication passed between them, as if he were giving her permission to reveal a truth. We believe that the radical terror group Al-Saif are working with the Combine to prepare another major strike against the West. You're familiar with the bombing in Barcelona. That was just the curtain raiser. All indicators point to an imminent attack on a major American city, but we don't know which. Rubicon was tracking a consignment of 6 Chinese-made missiles bought illegally from North Korea, and we believe that the Combine is going to supply them to Al-Saif. We have lost our lead on the missiles, Delancourt admitted. The North Korean general brokering the deal died in what appeared to be a road accident. Emphasis on appeared, suggested Mark. Delancourt gave a grim nod. That is representative of a major alteration in Combine tactics. It is what the Americans would call a game changer. They are moving from dealing in weapons to being proactive in organizing a terror strike. Al-Saif are the partners they have chosen for this unpleasant endeavor. So why don't you alert the CIA or Homeland Security? Mark replied. The Combine has penetrated several intelligence agencies, said Delancourt, a fact I think you are well aware of. Mark's jaw stiffened, but he let the comment pass. Will you work with us? Asked Solomon. We want the same thing, Mr. Dane, to expose these men and stop them before another atrocity happens. He hesitated. I know you have your doubts, but consider that if I simply wanted your knowledge, there are more direct methods that could have been employed to get it. Lucy's intervention in London allowed you to escape death on that rooftop. And again, we assisted you in Rome. These are not the acts of those who wish you harm. There were reasons why this was a bad idea. Mark knew that. But he also knew that his luck had run dry in Italy. And the fact was, he had no more cards to play. Without Keyes riding to the rescue, Mark would have most likely ended his life in a hail of bullets, or at best, spent it buried in some ghost prison until he was old and grey. He turned it around in his thoughts. There was an opportunity here. All that stuff about the Chinese rockets was news to Mark, but it fit the profile. If Solomon was on the level, if Rubicon really did have their own leads on the Combine, then having the backup of a multi-billion-dollar corporation could come in very useful, tracking down the people who had ordered the deaths of Nomad Team. Solomon's speech about responsibility had struck a chord with Mark, as much as it might have been idealistic, but he wasn't going to let that blind him to what was important to him. Mark saw Sam's face in his mind's eye, and once again a horrible second sense memory came back with the smell of blood and fire. He drew a breath and let the moment fade. I'm certain the Combine have someone inside MI6, he told them. I want to know who that is. Delancourt and Solomon exchanged a look. We don't have that information. Will you help me get it? Solomon nodded. If we can, we will. Okay. A strange sense of relief washed over Mark. I found something called Yeni Gun. It's a charity for war orphans in Eastern Europe. He said nothing else. Mark wasn't about to trust these people with everything he knew. Not yet. Henry? Solomon gestured to Delancourt.
and the other man produced a data tablet from inside his jacket. Un moment. He tapped at the device's screen, typing with his thumbs. I have it. The New Day. They have a number of rescue centers for displaced and orphaned youths in Anatolia and the surrounding regions. The main office is in Ankara. I found the location of what is supposed to be a New Day orphanage out in the foothills of the Taurus Mountains. I'm not sure what's there, but if the Combine's mole in MI6 thought it was important, it must mean something. Solomon went to an intercom panel on the wall and tapped a button. Flight deck.
Silver here, sir, said a male voice. Are we dropping off our new passenger?
No. Mr. Dane has agreed to work with us, Solomon replied. Mark didn't want to consider what exactly dropping off might have been a euphemism for, had he chosen to reject the billionaire's proposal. I need you to change course. Take us to Central Turkey.
Will do, said the pilot.
Almost immediately, Mark felt the floor beneath his feet tilting gently as the jetliner eased into a slow turn. Solomon came closer and offered Mark his hand.
Thank you, Mr. Dane, for your trust. I promise you it will be worthwhile.
Mark took the other man's hand and found Solomon's grip was firm and steady. It's not like I had a lot of choice, yeah? He got a rueful nod in return.
When someone's heart is honestly governed by what they believe, noted Solomon, that is all too often the case.
17. Dawn was moving in as Solomon's A350 rolled to a halt at a private hangar on the far side of Erkelet International Airport. It was going to be another hot, arid day in the Turkish heartland. Delancourt produced another fresh set of clothes for Mark, comprised of German-made tactical boots, ripstop cargo trousers, and a lightweight jacket, and at length returned his day pack with the contents intact. Mark didn't hesitate to activate the laptop and check the portable computer's security. His firewalls and lockout protocols had been tested but not penetrated, just as he had hoped. Still, he resolved to crack the laptop's case at the first opportunity to check for the presence of any bugs, keyloggers, or other unwanted additions. The day pack had also gained some extra content in the form of an emergency survival kit and a box of 9mm ammunition for the Glock. The pistol was in there too, and he was surprised to note that someone had cleaned it for him. 5-star service, he thought.
You may need that, Delancourt noted, nodding at the weapon.
But let us hope not, eh? Mark walked down the jetway, blinking into the rising sun. He dug in the bag for the USAF-issue sunglasses that he habitually carried and wiped them clean. Lucy was waiting at the foot of the ramp, dressed in the same kind of almost neutral clothing as he was. She was peering at a sheaf of paper maps, and among the sheets, Mark saw a blow-up of the satellite image he had provided to Rubicon, the errant picture salvaged from the comm files.
We can make this by late afternoon if we hustle, she told him.
A hello would draw too much attention. We'll take the highway. She jerked her thumb at a battered Land Rover parked in the shadow of the jet. Malt, the taciturn driver, was in the process of loading the 4x4 with two equipment cases, one labeled with a red stripe, another with blue. Is he coming with us? Lucy shook her head.
Just you and me, pal.
Oh, good, Mark shrugged. I mean, he's such a talker, wouldn't be able to get a word in edgewise.
That's funny, she said in a way that suggested she thought the exact opposite.
She walked away toward the car, and he trailed after her. Hey, he said to her back. I suppose I should thank you.
For Woolworth.
Where? Lucy didn't turn, giving Walt a smile as she passed him going the other way. The driver didn't even glance in Mark's direction, climbing back up the jetway without looking back.
London, Mark clarified. The roof.
Oh. She paused to give the Land Rover's tires a desultory kick. Yeah, that guy was going to smoke you, all right.
You didn't kill him, though, Mark noted. I mean, you must have had the shot, right?
She glanced at him. Wasn't my choice. It was yours.
He was just some tactical bud, he wasn't... Mark halted, frowning. He wasn't Combine.
Whatever you say, Slick. Lucy climbed behind the Land Rover's steering wheel, pausing to fix a dun-coloured headscarf in place over her hair. Mark took the passenger seat and found a threadbare cap he could pull down low to shade his eyes. She glanced at him and smiled thinly.
"Relax, Dane. I'm not going to drive you into the desert to put a bullet in your head and dump you in a ditch. That's not Solomon's style."
He tugged self-consciously on the bill of the cap. "In the last few days, almost everyone I thought I could count on has tried to arrest me or shoot me, so I may have some trust issues at this point." Lucy chuckled and put the car in gear.
"Buckle up," she told him. "We'll work on that as we go."
The early hour meant that traffic on the local roads was thin, and as they joined the D-300 highway heading southeast out of the city of Kayseri, there were few cars, but regular lines of trucks moving down the dual lanes. If there was a speed limit, Lucy Keys didn't seem to have any desire to obey it, and she kept the Land Rover at a swift pace, weaving the vehicle around the larger, slower-moving cargo carriers. Beyond the edges of the dusty road, the landscape was an expanse of brown and grey, patched by slivers of greenery that flashed past in ill-defined blurs. The hills and the mountains dominated the view ahead, growing larger as they closed in. At first, Mark's conflicted mood threatened to drag him away into a morose silence as his thoughts turned inward. But the last thing he wanted to do was dwell on the chain of events that had forced him into this situation. Second-guessing himself would only undermine his confidence, and right now he needed to keep his doubts at arm's length, until he could be sure that Solomon's people were really what they said they were. "So," he took a breath and looked across at Lucy. "You're from New York City, right? But not Brooklyn, I'm guessing. I'd say Queens, yeah?" She nodded, pursing her lips.
"Not bad. That's a pretty good call for a Brit. Most of you guys can't tell the difference."
"I'm good with accents," said Mark, making a circular motion with his finger. "Like some people have an ear for music, you know. Also, I watch a lot of American telly."
"Let me guess. Cop shows."
He shook his head. "Nah, sitcoms. Cop shows are too close to the job. Plus, they never get the little stuff right, and it pisses me off."
"I heard that," she agreed.
"People in Hollywood think if they park a yellow cab at the end of a street in L.A., it's a dead ringer for Manhattan. Or if there's a double-decker bus and some rain, it's London."
"What? You guys have sunny days?" she smirked.
"Huh? Who knew?" Out of nowhere, Mark felt an unexpected pang of regret. He'd grown up in London and lived there for most of his adult life. The sudden possibility that he might never get to return carried more weight than he was ready for.
"You miss it? New York, I mean?"
"I miss the food," said Lucy with feeling. He sensed a moment of shared regret between them, as if they were both some kind of exile.
"How did you end up in all this? Working for Rubicon, I mean."
She shot him a look, and he wondered if he had touched on a sore point. Lucy guided the Land Rover past a sluggish tanker truck and set her gaze on the view through the grimy windshield.
"It's no big deal," she said at length. "I was Army Green for a good while. No job for a lady, so my mum used to say. But I got a good eye, and I like guns. Delta was recruiting for Foxtrot Troop, so I opted in. Stay for a tour."
"I thought that was a myth," said Mark, "about Delta Force having an all-female squad."
"Sure it is," Lucy replied evenly. "Just like it's not true that British intelligence has its own covert strike teams."
"Fair point," he allowed.
"Uncle Sam may be old-fashioned, but he ain't stupid. Sometimes girls can get where boys can't."
Mark nodded. "You'll get no argument from me."
"So you're ex-Royal Navy, right?"
He tensed.
"How'd you know that?"
Lucy pointed at his arm.
"Cabot wristwatch, it's a dead giveaway."
Mark frowned. The military-issued dive watch was the only connection he still had to that part of his past.
"And also my boss is a billionaire, remember?" the woman went on. "Information gets bought real easy if you know how to deal."
She smiled again.
"So you're all about queen and country, from Navy puke to covert spook, all for the Union Jack."
Something like that, he muttered. And just so you know, we only call the flag the Union Jack if it's flying on a ship.
Oh, yeah?
Lucy cocked her head. How about that? Every day's a school day. They passed another car, and the other driver leaned on the horn to show his displeasure at Lucy's cavalier attitude to the rules of the road. Mark cinched his seatbelt a little tighter. So why did you pack it in with the army? He was aware that she'd tried to steer the conversation away from that subject, but Mark wasn't ready to let that drop without pushing a little more. Solomon made me a better offer, she said. Lucy seemed as if she was going to say something else, but then the impulse faded. That was all he was going to get. Mark guessed there was more to the story, but he wouldn't hear it today. She pointed at a road sign as they approached the outskirts of a town, at the base of a low mountain. Pinabasi. We turn south here, to the provincial border. Roads will get rougher once we start into the foothills. Mark threw a glance over his shoulder back down the highway. I can take the wheel for a spell if you want.
No need.
Lucy didn't look away from the road. Without an operation in progress, the Hub White command room seemed hollow to Talia Patel, still haunted by the ghosts of the events of Op Team Nomad's fatal mission. For now, the room's large main screens were the only active system, each paired with the discrete bulb of a digital camera looking down on the table and the rank of chairs that faced them. Wells and one of his ninth-floor men were already there when she entered, behind Royce, and he spared them both an arch look. "Here we are again," he began. "We should stop meeting like this, Donald. People are going to talk." "Oh, Victor," Royce said quietly as he sat down. "Do sod off." Talia blinked at her superior's offhand insult. It wasn't like him to so easily rise to the bait, but then the stress of recent days was starting to tell. Royce had repeatedly ignored suggestions to take some time away from operations, and Talia was aware that he hadn't been home for the last few nights. Wells thought better of digging up any kind of comeback, and covered the moment with a sniff and a glance at the clock on the far wall. The minute hand snapped around to the top of the hour, and the three screens lit up, along with red LEDs beneath the cameras. The displays showed an almost identical conference room setup. Only the quality of the daylight and the time stamp in the corner of the images broke the illusion. The other end of the teleconference was a room in the British Embassy in Rome. Two people looked back out at them. A woman, Talia didn't know, helpfully identified by the screen's image recognition software as Lane T. And John Farrier, who seemed to have aged 10 years since she last saw him in the flesh. "Secure," reported Farrier, his lips thinning. "Let's get to this." Ignoring any pretense at protocol, Wells leaned forward and launched into a cold-eyed snarl. "I won't waste time by going through a laundry list of your security detachment's shortcomings. I don't care how Mark Dane got into the compound, but I do want to know how he got out of it again." He glared at Lane and Farrier. "Any takers?"
"He had outside help," said the woman.
"Of course he bloody did," snapped Wells. "I wonder if he had some inside as well." Farrier's gaze sharpened. "If you've got something you want to say, spit it out." Wells produced a data pad and laid it on the table. "I have information on a piece of Op-Team hardware Dane used to cause a road accident in the middle of central London. Tech that, as far as my investigators can determine, he wasn't issued with."
"I don't know anything about that," Farrier replied, and Talia saw a stony cast come over the other man's face. Had Farrier actually intervened in order to get Mark free? She didn't want to think about the implications if that were true.
"I find it interesting that when Dane was on the run, when he had a million different places to hide, it was you he came looking for." Wells cocked his head. "According to the details from Lane's report, you were out of contact for almost 15 minutes while Dane had you as his so-called hostage."
"He trusted me," Farrier snapped. "Because you didn't give him any other option. That's why he came to my door."
"What did he say to you?"
Royce spoke up.
"I told him to surrender," Farrier went on. "He wouldn't listen. He said he was innocent,
that he had nothing to do with the loss of Nomad. The other man paused. And for the record, I believe him.
What you believe is of little interest to me, said Wells. Dane's a fugitive. He had the chance to come quietly, and now he's racking up criminal charges like they're going out of style.
Royce sighed. He wanted access to the secure messaging network. Your report says that he coerced you into giving him your passwords. Farrier nodded.
That's right.
Why? Said Royce. What was he looking for?
Mark believes there's been a penetration at the cross.
Farrier let that statement hang for a moment. Talia found herself stiffening at the possibility.
He thinks the ambush that took out Nomad was expedited with the help of someone inside the circle.
Which is exactly the kind of explanation he would give if he were that insider, Wells insisted. An innocent man doesn't run.
He might, if he thinks he's going to vanish down a deep, dark hole and never see the light of day again, noted Royce.
Wells dismissed the comment with a snort.
How long were you alone with him in the embassy comms room? What did he do while he was there?
A few minutes. He got nothing, said Farrier. Check the logs yourself. He tried to break through the firewalls and botched it. In the end, he gave up.
Talia glanced at her own pad, which contained the same reports Wells was referring to. A records dump from the embassy mainframe showed that someone had attempted to access the MI6 network through a secure terminal, but all the activity log contained were dozens of rebuffed calls as the system denied entry over and over again. The log made it seem like Dane had spent several frustrating minutes repeatedly trying and failing to get in. But then Mark Dane was one of the best op-team field technicians they had, and Talia imagined that he was more than capable of erasing an actual activity log and replacing it with something like this to blind them to what he had really been doing.
For the moment, let's move on to a different concern. Wells threw a glance at his pad. His escape route, the vehicle, the woman, let's talk about them.
Talia had given image captures from the embassy's exterior security cameras a priority run through every available database, and now she manipulated one of the screens to bring up a ladder of images.
We are working on getting traffic camera footage from the police in Rome, but the Italian Secret Service are dragging their heels. They said, and I quote, "The Servizio per la Informazione e la Sicurezza Democratica expect complete disclosure of the situation in order to facilitate full cooperation. They are making a lot of noise about what they see as a terrorist incident in their capital."
"We're telling them it was a hoax," said Lane. "They're not buying it."
Talia went on. "Without street footage, we can't lock down where the vehicle went after leaving the area. But our teams in image analysis have some facts about the car itself."
She showed them a computer model of the dark-colored Toyota RAV4.
"Based on the weight distribution and axle height, the car was fitted with bulletproofing and other modifications. There's also evidence that they launched some kind of surveillance drone."
"Show us the woman," said Wells.
Off a nod from Royce, Talia brought up a different image. This one, a blurry still of a dark face peering out of an open car door.
"Facial mapping gave us a good hit," she explained. "We found a 71% probability match."
"Who is Dane's new friend?"
Wells studied the still, taken just as Mark had vaulted toward the waiting SUV.
"When I ran her through the NATO force records database, we came across this."
The picture of the woman was replaced by a different image, the same face but younger, somehow harder. In the second photograph, she was dressed in the sand and brown shades of a United States Army desert camo uniform.
"Lucille Roshan Keys," said Wells, reading out the name appended to the file. "Says there she was in the logistics corps."
"That's American shorthand for special forces," noted Farrier.
"Why would the cousins want to grab Dane?" said Royce.
"We don't think they did." Talia shook her head. "Keys isn't with the Americans anymore, at least as far as we can tell."
She put up a different file, and this one was an arrest warrant.
"Full details are classified, but there was an incident that resulted in Keys being dishonorably discharged and convicted of criminal conduct. She was sentenced by a closed military court and remanded to the Naval Consolidated Brig in Miramar, Florida. Information on what she did and the terms of her punishment are redacted.
Wells pointed at the screen. She can't be in a military prison and a Rome backstreet at the same time.
We have fragmentary reports about an escape 4 years ago from Miramar, Talia went on. Key's details appear on a fugitive watch list very shortly afterwards. I'll need to reach out to the U.S. Department of Defense or the CIA if we want hard data.
Royce shook his head. Don't do that, unless we have absolutely no other option. The last thing we want is the Langley boys getting involved in this. Sir Oliver would hang the lot of us.
Still time for that, Wells retorted. So we have a former U.S. spec ops shooter, possibly still being run by the Americans, but more likely selling herself to the highest bidder, acting as taxi driver for a rogue British intelligence officer. Who wants to be the one to break news of this delightful development to the director and the JIC?
No one spoke, and so he turned his glare on Farrier.
You listen to me. I want you on the next RAF transport back to Brize Norton. Is that clear?
Farrier looked to Royce for support, but the other man just shook his head.
There will need to be a more thorough debriefing, Royce said.
Talia saw Farrier's stony expression slip for a moment, before it hardened once again.
All right. Lane, you handle things there. Lean on the locals. Get that camera footage, Wells told her. We need to know where Keyes took him, if they're still in Italy or not. Get it done.
Yes, sir.
Lane gave a nod and the screens went dark.
Wells rounded on Royce. A redacted file. You know what that suggests, Donald. This Keyes woman did something so unpleasant that her commanders wanted her buried alive.
He drew in a sharp breath through his teeth. That's our phantom sniper, and I wouldn't be surprised if she was there in Dunkirk to kill Dane's teammates as well.
You don't know that, Royce began, but there was no strength behind the denial. Open your eyes,
Wells barked, startling Talia.
You think I'm trying to shaft you because of the checkered history between us? Well, let me make this crystal clear.
He leaned in. As much as I dislike you, I will bring Mark Dane to book because I believe he's responsible for killing British servicemen and betraying his oath to the crown, not because I want to knock off K-section.
Now, you either get on side with me and fix the holes in your leaky ship, or you'll go down with him.
He pushed past Talia and out of Hub White, his assistant trailing silently behind him. She turned to Royce, but he wouldn't meet her gaze.
Sir, I...
Just find him, Talia, he said bleakly, before he can cause any more problems. The road degraded with every mile they travelled, losing the asphalt and then the dust and gravel, until it was only the most basic suggestion of an actual track. A sun-faded Yenigun sign, the colours bleached away into nothing, rattled gently in the dry winds by the entrance to the orphanage compound. There was no movement around the discoloured walls, and Lucy turned the Land Rover about in a slow crawl, the tyres crunching on the desiccated earth. She scanned the windows. Black squares punched through the sides of the silent blockhouses, looking for threats. As the grumble of the engine died, Mark heard the moan of the steady breeze, and the desolate cluster of buildings seemed like the loneliest place on earth.
Stay alert, said Lucy, reaching down into the wheel well to grab her backpack. We don't know what we're going to find here.
She reached inside, and her hand came back with the compact shape of an MP7 submachine gun. She cocked it with a snap of the receiver and handed Mark a walkie-talkie.
Just in case, she added.
Mark followed her out of the Land Rover, slipping out of the door with his bag over one shoulder. He had the Glock ready, close to his chest, and his finger resting on the trigger guard. He felt acutely aware of every tiny detail around them. The crumbling rocks beneath his boots, the heavy heat of the late afternoon sun, the weight of the loaded gun. Lucy called out something in a language that sounded like Arabic, and then again in English.
Anyone here? Show your face!
No answer came back to them, and she moved off. Mark kept with her, glancing at the razor wire fences, All that was needed to hammer home the ghost town nature of the compound were some rolling tumbleweeds. They approached a covered quad near two long, low huts. Thick tent cloth kept the whole area in shade, and it snapped as the wind passed over it. Mark paused in the shadow and peered up at the underside of the material, noticing the strange metallic weave. That's thermal baffling up there, designed to reflect heat. Russians used it during the Cold War to fake out spy satellites with infrared cameras. Whoever ran this place was taking precautions, Lucy noted. Her manner had shifted from the attitude she displayed on the ride up here. Her dash of the brash was replaced by something cooler, more professional. She pointed at one of the dusty prefabricated huts. Let's take a look. The outbuildings were repurposed Quonset huts, Second World War vintage, curves of rusting galvanized steel vibrating with the heat of the day. A musty odor hit him as he entered, sparking unpleasant recall of sweaty changing rooms in the comprehensive school where he had spent his early teens. Ranks of bed frames stood in lines all the way to the far wall. This is where the kids slept, I guess, said Lucy. Beds are too short for adults. Mark fell into a crouch and used his phone to snap a couple of pictures. Scrape marks on the floor, he pointed them out. No dust on the frames, so they must have been used recently. The hallmarks of an evacuation, she said, looking around. Move on. The main building next, I reckon. They crossed the covered quad and headed toward the only two-story building in the compound. Mark thought he saw something more than just shadows in the lee of one of the support poles, a dark, rust-brown patch on the sandy ground. But he didn't draw attention to it. He followed Lucy's silent hand gestures to stack up either side of the front door and slowly ease it open. The door was already hanging loose, and it gave a sullen creak as it came the rest of the way. Mark braced himself, imagining that there could be some angry thug with an assault rifle waiting within. But there was no hail of bullets, no sudden report of fire. The building was as dead as the rest of the orphanage, dark where the shadows fell deep, lit only by shafts of sunshine that caught motes of dust as they advanced down the main corridor. The first room they came to had towers of wooden cubbyholes either side of the door, and Lucy used her booted foot to kick it open. Over her shoulder, Mark glimpsed an almost empty space with a few scattered cushions in one corner and a thick red carpet on the floor. The color worn pink by years of feet and hands upon it. Classroom, he suggested. Lucy scowled, seemingly reluctant to enter, and she peeled back the headscarf she was wearing to set it around her neck and shoulders. Prayer room, she corrected. Mark drifted across the corridor to the next door, which opened onto a windowless space with reinforced walls. Empty rows of shelving filled every available corner, and the scent of machine oil was soaked into the brickwork. The shine of brass caught his eye, and he plucked a lone bullet from where it had fallen to the floor. It was a live 7.62 round, the ammunition of choice for the venerable Kalashnikov assault rifle. "They missed one," he said, placing it on the shelf, standing alone like a tiny, tall, hatted sentry. "What kind of orphanage has an armory?" She didn't answer him. Instead, pointing with the MP7. "Anything we can use will probably be on the upper floor. We need actionable intel." Mark followed her back out and then up the creaking stairs, wondering if this expedition would bear fruit. He thought again about Rix's words on the Palomino, in those moments before the ship had been consumed in fire. Rix had said there were children on the ship, and Mark couldn't help trying to connect that with the lead that had brought them here, thousands of miles away, to a place that was supposed to care for lost youths and war orphans. If the New Day charity was cover for a partnership between the Combine and Al-Saif, then it was a singularly callous one. On the upper floor, there was the heavy trace of burnt paper in the air. Low on one wall, Mark saw a scrawl of writing in hasty calligraphic script, scratched into the peeling paint across the brickwork. "Kilroy was here," he said aloud, guessing at the significance of the tiny act of defiance. "It's a name," Lucy told him. "Halil. It means good friend." "You read Arabic as well, then?"
I got a lot of talents, she replied. Trigger puller is just my best one. Lucy pointed across the hall. Check this out. Mark followed her into another room, and inside the stench of dead fires was thick, the roughness of the soot collecting at the back of his throat. Along one side of the room, a desk had been piled high with papers and set alight, left to burn until all that remained were ashen piles that retained some ghost of their original shape. Battered filing cabinets sat with their drawers hanging open, emptied of anything that might have been useful. Lucy stopped suddenly and dropped to her haunches, shouldering her MP7 on a bungee sling, so she could have both hands free. Problem? Said Mark. Looksy, she replied, pointing. Mark peered at the floor and made out a thin line of fishing wire suspended at ankle height. Oh, bollocks, he breathed, as he followed it to its end. Hidden in the debris was a roughly egg-shaped object Mark recognized as a Soviet RGD-5 anti-personnel fragmentation grenade. The part of his memory that belonged to his techie soul, the bit of him that was the legacy of a bookish child who could name 100 kinds of dinosaur or recognize all the variants of a Spitfire, dutifully reeled off the specs of the device in a way that wasn't at all comforting. Most notably, he remembered that the Russian grenade had a timer that could easily be set to anything from 12 to 0 seconds. Yeah, agreed Lucy. Stay back. No. I got this, he said, pulling a folding multi-tool from his belt. Without waiting, Mark moved in and severed the line. In a few moments, he had made the booby trap safe. Huh? She said, and there was something new in her eyes, something that could have been respect. You're good for something. Grunwald looked up as the hatch banged open and the Englishman that the jihadis called Tommy strode in. His thuggish glower swept the compartment and found the mercenary. Well, he demanded, what have we got? See for yourself, said Grunwald. What had once been one of the Santa Cruz's smaller cargo bays had been converted into a makeshift operations room with video monitors and a military communications rig. A blurry 10-second loop of footage, black and white imagery shot from great altitude, showed a sparse landscape and a cluster of buildings. Teep, who sat before the workstation, pointed a long finger at the bottom of the screen. There. The video loop ended and started again, and where the American indicated, a light-colored rectangle moved into the frame and performed a slow circle. Mid-sized vehicle, he noted. Two people get out. Ellis stood watching off to one side. Where's this come from? Demanded the Englishman.
Camera time leased off one of the Indian government's weather satellites, Grunwald sniffed.
That could be anyone down there, Ellis spoke up.
It's him, said Tommy, nodding to himself.
Yeah, no other fucker is going to grind up miles of dirt road to that shithole without good reason.
He took the bait.
What bait? Said Ellis.
Tommy answered without looking at him.
The problem with clever bastards is they like being clever. So you give them something that makes them feel smarter than you, they're at it like a rat up a drainpipe.
He leaned in and tap-tapped one of the moving dots on the screen, as if he could speak to the person it represented through the gesture.
You hear that, mate? We led you there, you little prick.
We lost direct video a couple of minutes ago, said Grunwald.
The Englishman ran a hand over his chin, rasping at the stubble there.
Kadir's boys left booby traps. Might have done the job for us. But best make sure. Belt and braces.
He pointed at another monitor, which showed a tactical map of the area off the Turkish coastline.
The Yanks are still out there, right?
Grunwald nodded. But we won't have access for much longer. If we are going to use them as an asset, we have to do it soon.
Tommy grinned wolfishly. Well then,
better let them have some.
Proceed, said Grunwald, placing a hand on Teep's shoulder.
The American nodded and typed in a pre-designated communications code into the keyboard in front of him. Hundreds of kilometers to the east, a task force from the United States Navy's 6th Fleet out of Naples lay on station. The flotilla sat in a staggered row across a small corner of the Mediterranean, almost following the sword-tipped line of Cyprus's Cape
Apostolis Andreas, toward the edges of Syrian territorial waters. The U.S. Navy's mission brief in the area was defined to the rest of the world as tactical presence, a very visible deterrent to the belligerent forces of ISIL in the local theatre, and a way of rattling America's sabres at nearby Russian military assets. There were also other facets to the operation that were less perceptible to global observers. One of them was designated as Tasking Element Argonaut, a rapid reaction mission that could be deployed within minutes from the task force's main aircraft carrier. Argonaut's objective was simple and direct: to use fast, stealthy UCAV drones to take out sites designated as terrorist training camps or other targets of opportunity. Battle planners in the US Navy kept out of the evolving drone war by the dominance of the USAF have been only happy to secure their future budgets by taking on the mission, showing that sea-based, unmanned combat aircraft could do the job just as well. It was no coincidence that assets managed by the Combine were also embedded in the command and control pipeline of Argonaut. Under the guise of orders direct from Washington, signed off on by military chiefs sympathetic to Combine interests, it only took a few short moments for Teep to contact the flotilla and impersonate a naval officer halfway across the world.
"Stormline! Action order," announced Teep, speaking into a headset microphone, using the carrier's radio ID code. "Tasking Element Argonaut. Expedite immediate. Deployment confirmation is..." He paused to peer at a slip of paper on the folding table before him. "Romeo 9, 7 Kilo, 2 Zebra Lima. How copy?" The value of that string of letters and numbers was measured in the ghostly coin of the Combine's power and influence. There was a crackle of static, and then a voice responded.
"Good copy. Code matches. Stormline confirms. Deployment underway. Stand by."
Grunwald smiled thinly. Somewhere out in the med, a robot aircraft was being hustled to a deck elevator, and within 10 minutes it would be airborne. He glanced at another screen, where the details of a strike package were displayed. This was the pre-programmed mission for the UCAV, a series of waypoints and direction markers now being uploaded to the Navy drone. The strike had been planned months ago as just one more constituent of a larger plan, as another method of erasing a loose end left behind by the collaboration with Al-Saif. The mercenary glanced at Tommy. It had been the Englishman's idea to delay the use of the drone after the problem with the technician Dane had blown up, to use it now and, as he put it, kill two birds with one stone. After the launch, the drone jet would vanish below radar detection height and cross the Turkish coastline, powering northward. Such an action would be a violation of the borders of a NATO member nation, so all the more reason to ensure that no human pilot would be part of the mission loop, and that no direct control by the mothership would be in place by the time the UCAV reached its target. In an hour, the drone would be back over the med, circling the carrier it had launched from, its weapons load a little lighter, and its mission record scrubbed clean. And they would have one less problem to concern them.
"Argonaut 2 is away," reported the radio voice. "Good launch."
"Confirmed," Teep responded.
An unpleasant sneer tugged at the corner of Tommy's lips.
"If this don't do it," he said, almost to himself, "I'll walk out there and strangle the bastard myself."
18. Mark had assumed that after the whole tripwire situation, Lucy's rather confident attitude might have toned down a little, but that didn't appear to be the case. He winced as she used a swift kick from an army boot to smash open the lock on a door, the mechanism coming away with a crunch of fresh splinters. The upper floor's corridors converged on this one doorway, and Mark guessed that the building had been deliberately constructed to have two distinct sectors that could only be accessed via choke points. His theory was confirmed when they found poorly built walls extended out into the passage, making it into a chicane. Lucy threw him a look. "See those?" He nodded. "To slow down anyone coming through. Blockades to break up lines of fire.
Which means the people here were paranoid about getting a SEAL team wake-up one dark night. Yeah, something like that. With the Glock held close, he eased open a door off the main corridor and peeked through. It was another dormitory, but unlike the ones in the outbuildings, this was better appointed. Of course, better was subjective, in terms of having actual glass in the windows and a ceiling that wasn't pockmarked with holes. The denuded bedsteads were clearly adult-sized bunks, with cloth privacy curtains hanging between them like limp flags. A widescreen television, set up in one corner of the room, was the only thing that seemed out of place, and Mark noticed a DVD player and a pile of discs at the foot of it. "I'm guessing those aren't rom-coms," Lucy offered. "They bunk the adults here." Mark moved away, back down the corridor, like tutors and pupils in a boarding school. She followed him, frowning. Safe bet they weren't teaching them about peace and harmony. The corridor ended at a lightless stairwell that went straight down to the basement, vanishing into the hot shadows. Lucy held out a hand to him, her expression turning stony. She said nothing, instead making a silent gesture that told Mark to keep behind her. He nodded and let her take point. Lucy brought the MP7 up, the muzzle hunting for targets. Mark held his pistol out and down, ready to snap it up to firing position if he saw a threat. They descended into the darkness, and the air closed in on them, thick and unmoving. A cloying smell seeped into Mark's throat and nostrils. Lucy eased open a rusty door, and the odor came at him full force. Charred meat. The same awful charnel house stench from the docks in Dunkirk. He swallowed hard, tasting the acidic burn of bile in the back of his throat, and gripped the gun tighter. The room was a large space. Floor and walls tiled in washed-out sea green. Illumination blazed from a buzzing neon tube that threw stark light across everything. In the middle of the room was a discolored drain grill set at the hub of a dozen shallow gutters, and gathered around it were patches of what could only be blood. Flies spun around the freshest of the brown puddles. Mark turned slowly in place, not wanting to, but unable to stop himself from picturing what had taken place here. A metal autopsy table had been shoved off to one side. "Gunshot kills," Lucy announced, her voice flat and empty. "What?" Mark's mouth was dry. She pointed at the patches. If a knife had been used, there would be spray. Someone, more than one, was brought down here and shot dead. Mark forced himself to study the scene dispassionately, and he saw holes in the tile, where some eager executioner had missed with their first shot, or else put a bullet right through the body of their subject. "What the hell is this all for?" She didn't answer him. Instead, Lucy made for another steel door on the far side of the room. Poorly oiled hinges gave a low moan as it opened, and dry, dusty air wafted out. The other section of the basement took up the rest of the building's lower level, dominated by a large furnace. It was barely alight, but still a weak glow shone through the gaping maw of the fire pit, and Mark glimpsed spindly shapes among the ashes that he didn't want to study more closely. Lucy didn't share his reticence. She peered inside before turning her head to spit. "Fuck," she breathed. Mark's gaze dropped to the floor, and he found himself looking at pieces of torn paper, probably dropped from piles of documents, as they'd been taken to be burned. He crouched, grateful for something else to focus on. The paper was yellow, tissue thin, the kind of tear sheet that you would be handed by a deliveryman. He used a pen to tease the fragment open, and saw strings of symbols he couldn't read. "Hey," he said without looking up. "What does this say?" Lucy loomed over him, scowling. "A date? Not sure. You think that could be something?" He nodded. There was part of a letterhead visible and a logo that showed outlines of a truck, a plane, and a boat. "Might be a bill of lading." Mark cast around and found more bits of paper with the same color and form. "Maybe several." She drew a black rectangle out of her pocket and offered it to him. "Take pictures. Use this." Lucy paused to look at the device. It was a smartphone of some kind, but Mark couldn't see any manufacturer's mark or identifying symbols. The phone beeped and came alive. A facial recognition lock, he realized. Rubicon were clearly serious about operational security for their field agents. He smoothed out the pieces of paper on the dusty floor and took a string of shots. The smartphone's bright flash lighting up the room like a strobe. I've got some image processing software on my laptop we could use on this. Lucy shook her head. Solomon's got a whole lab full of geeks for that. Oh, right. Mark nodded to himself. He'd become used to working alone in the past few days, and it seemed strange to think about being part of a team again, even if it might only be a temporary state of affairs. She snatched the phone from him and tapped out a string of text on the screen. No signal down here. Lucy handed it back again. Go outside. See if you can get a couple of bars. It'll send the email automatically. She looked away. I'll see what else I can find. Mark took the opportunity without hesitating, grateful for it. The sickly air of the basement was oppressive, and all he wanted at that moment was to be out of there. Mark came to a halt and shielded his eyes with the flat of his hand, squinting into the sunlight. He took a deep breath of fresh air and tried to convince himself that the death stink from the basement hadn't followed him out here. As much as he wanted to think about something, anything else, his thoughts kept returning to Dunkirk, to the weight of Sam Green's body in his arms, and the ashen stench that was all that remained of her hours later, clinging to him as if it had soaked into his pores. Piss off! He spat the curse at nothing, angry at himself, dispelling the horrible moment of recollection with a snarl. The Land Rover was nearby, and he trudged over to it, opening the passenger door to find a bottle of mineral water lodged in the footwell. The water was warm and tasted of plastic, but it helped wash away the scent memory. Mark drained most of it, and then on impulse, he tore off his cap and splashed the remainder over his face and neck. It seemed to help. Pulling Lucy's ghost phone from his pocket, he held it up and moved around in a circle, squinting at the line of signal bars as he wandered across the quad. He must have looked like an idiot, arm out above his head, waving at nothing. Out here, a decent cellular link was more rare than a rainy day, but Mark was willing to bet that Mr. Solomon would equip his people with something a little better than the latest device from Apple. The device gave off a sonar-like ping as it found the thinnest margin of a carrier signal, and presently a little icon flashed into life, showing a letter zipping away into the ether. Done, Mark began, dropping his arm. He was turning back toward the main building when he saw sunshine flicker off something moving fast against the distant hillside. He was still processing what he saw when the wind brought him the rolling whine of an aero engine. The sound immediately seemed off. The pitch was all wrong, too high for a fighter jet, not enough bass and chop for a helicopter. Then he saw it again, and Mark's mind caught up with him at shocking speed. Still distant, but clear as it crested a scrub-covered hill, he saw a torpedo-like fuselage sporting twin tailplanes and sharp-edged wings with the dark void of a jet intake across its dorsal hull. Mark snatched the walkie-talkie from his belt and mashed the transmit tab. "We have a problem," he shouted. "We got incoming aircraft." The American woman's voice crackled back at him. "Turkish Air Force?" He shook his head. Not that she could see the gesture. "Only if the U.S. Navy has started selling them Sea Avenger UCAVs." The drone passed behind another hill, banking toward the compound. "It's definitely coming this way." Mark's words cut off as the unmanned aircraft made a fast pass over the orphanage, and the whining engine echoed off the landscape. The sunlight flash came again, and now the drone was close enough that he could see it reflecting off a pod along the centerline of the aircraft, a cluster of lenses feeding images back in real time to whomever was directing the machine. When Lucy's voice came over the radio again, he heard the grim resolve in her voice. "That thing is here to kill us." "I'm pretty sure I haven't done anything to annoy the American government." As he spoke, Mark was keeping low, watching to see where the drone would pop up. "The Navy didn't send it," she said flatly. "It's a loner. Listen to me. Small arms won't be enough to deal with it. I need you to get to the car, get the gun case." Rather than answer, Mark broke into a sprint across the quad, back toward the Land Rover. As he moved, he heard the echo of the drone's engine. It was turning, gaining height.
The first low-level pass had been to scope out the target. The next approach would be rolling in with weapons hot. Mark knew the Avenger UCAV could carry a reconnaissance package, a load of 250-pounder bombs, or, as this model did, clusters of lethal AGM-114 Hellfire air-to-ground missiles. Even a near hit from one of them would be enough to bring an explosive end to Mark Dane's fugitive odyssey. He slammed into the side of the Land Rover and scrambled to the rear door, wrenching it open. The two cases he had seen Mort loading that morning at the airport were still there, one with a red stripe across it, another with a blue stripe resting on top. As Mark's fingers closed around the handle of the blue case, from behind him he heard a distinct shift in engine pitch as the drone came around. Mark hauled the long case out with a grunt of effort. It was heavier than he had expected, and he couldn't stop himself from casting a look over his shoulder. It was a decision he immediately regretted. He saw the drone in the near distance, nose low and framed against the afternoon sky. There was a flash of ignition beneath the Avenger's belly as one of the missiles dropped from its internal munitions bay. The Hellfire came curving in, a trail of white smoke describing its approach. He vaulted away from the Land Rover, the case held in a death grip, running as fast as he could across the quad. Mark heard the shrill, falling shriek of the missile as it dove at the parked 4x4, the warhead meeting the metal of the sun-warmed hood with a massive thud. He left the ground and tumbled as a wave of burnt air hit him from behind and blasted him off his feet. He lost the gun case and landed hard on his shoulder, rolling across the ground. Hot, petrol-stinking fumes washed over him, and he choked on dust. Mark scrambled to his feet. The Land Rover was gone, what pieces of it remained reduced to blackened twists of steel. A flaming pit marked the strike point, a pennant of dark smoke curling up into the air. The wind pulled at it, dragging the haze across the compound. His ear felt wet, and he touched it, his finger coming away bloody. Some tiny fragment of the exploding car had nicked him as he fled. Up above, the drone was already turning inbound for another attack run.
"Good kill," said Teep, watching the feed from Argonaut 2.
The screen in front of him resembled some abstract wargame simulation. The buildings of the orphanage compound rendered as blank boxes, and the contours of the local landscape a series of nested green lines. The feed was coming in with a near-zero delay, beamed right to the Santa Cruz by a clandestine link off Stormline's network.
"If he's still breathing, then it's no kind of kill at all," sneered Ellis.
He was watching a different monitor. This one, a side-looking view from a video camera in the Avenger drone's recon pod. He pointed to a flicker moving below as the UCAV banked.
"Still got a live target down there."
Grunwald said nothing, turning to glance at the Englishman. The soldier's face was set in a hawkish glare, watching every return on the main screen in front of Teep. Tommy leaned forward and pointed.
"Cover," he noted. "Target that and hit him again."
Teep nodded and moved a mouse pointer over the tactical display, click-dragging a targeting box over the tent-like structure the Englishman indicated. He wasn't strictly piloting the drone. The Avenger's onboard computer was smart enough to manage something as simple as a standard flight path, but it was still necessary for an element of human input to be required for the firing of an actual weapon. The drone obeyed Teep's new orders and shifted position, bringing its nose to bear so the next Hellfire could acquire the designated target. At the other screen, Ellis was running the video feed back a few moments. A hard drive stored a digital recording of everything the drone observed, and now he set the playback running in slow reverse. The moment of the first missile hit unfolding backwards. Grunwald watched the orange fireball shrink and fade, the Hellfire rebuild itself and retreat from the parked Land Rover. At length, Ellis found what he was looking for and drew the other mercenary's attention.
"There he is."
Grunwald looked and saw that Ellis had captured a single frozen image, a man running at full tilt to escape the destruction of the vehicle. It was undoubtedly Mark Dane, the same ragged hair and the unshaven face he had seen atop Mount Etna.
"He should be dead, five times over," Grunwald said sourly.
"Luck," offered Ellis.
the word like a curse. The Dower Afrikaner would never be willing to accept that someone like Dane had slipped their grasp through any other means. But we're gonna run that clock out, yeah? Mark found the gun case where it had fallen and grabbed it, lurching away from the remains of the Land Rover. The heat from the explosion made his skin feel sunburned, and his ears were still ringing from the detonation. He was only aware of Lucy when she grabbed his arm, yanking him toward the thermal cloth tent with a hard tug on one of the daypack straps.
"This way!"
she shouted, but her voice was woolly, like it was coming to him from underwater.
"Back to the building!"
Mark nodded, and let her lead him back the way she had come. As they made it to the entrance hall, he felt, rather than heard, the second missile hit. The blast put them both down, and they stumbled as a wave of displaced dust churned in through the open doors.
"Six Hellfires,"
Mark said, his own voice sounding oddly muffled. "Enough to blast this hill into rubble." Lucy wasn't listening to him. She pulled at the gun case, and her expression turned thunderous.
"You got the wrong goddamn box."
"What?"
"These are the non-lethals."
She wrenched the lid open and grimaced at what lay inside.
"Red for dead. Blue for screwed."
Mark threw a glance over his shoulder, out through the doorway toward the burning pit. Whatever had been in the back of the Land Rover was splinters and wreckage, same as the vehicle.
"How was I supposed to know?"
he spat back at her. Inside the case, there were a few flash grenades, along with other kit he didn't recognize. Lucy grabbed at a taser pistol and then angrily threw it down.
"Great. We can't even dent that thing with this Star Trek shit."
Mark ignored her and reached for the largest device in the case. It unfolded as he removed it, a skeleton stock snapping open to reveal a trigger and pistol grip beneath. The weapon was the size of a short-frame assault rifle, but where a conventional firearm would have had its mechanism, there was a solid block of electronics resembling a fuse box. The device terminated in a curved dish antenna, giving the whole thing the look of a sci-fi ray gun built from electrical spares. Fluorescent warning stickers covered the weapon, forbidding users to operate the gun without protective gear for more than 10 seconds at a time, not to look directly into the emitter head. He saw a telltale hazard symbol, a yellow triangle showing a stylized radio mast beaming out ripples of radiation, and understanding clicked into place. "This is a Herf gun."
"It's useless, that's what it is."
Lucy looked up at the ceiling, listening for the drone's return. "Unless you want to microwave a burrito before we buy the farm. That thing's a crowd-control prototype, not for anti-aircraft fire." It was also all they had.
"We need to get to the roof."
He thumbed the on-off switch. "High-energy radio frequencies, yeah? Enough of that shot at anything will cook it from the inside out, even a drone."
"You are going to get killed."
He shook his head.
"No. We are going to get killed when that drone spears us with a missile, so we may as well go out swinging."
He broke into a run and heard Lucy swear again as she came after him. Mark emerged onto the roof of the building, blinking furiously in the bright sunshine. The Herf gun was large and cumbersome, banging against his chest as he dashed across the flat roof. He was aware of Lucy a few steps behind, panning around with her MP7. Mark slipped and dropped to a clumsy halt at the eastern end of the building, on his knees behind the raised parapet. From here, he would have had a view of the entire New Day orphanage, had parts of it not been on fire or blown apart by missile impacts. He raised the Herf gun to sight along the top of it and became aware that the thing was humming gently to itself. Directly in his eyeline was a warning panel, reminding Mark that what he held in his hand was essentially the guts of a powerful magnetron, and that prolonged use of it was likely to blind him. Lucy's earlier comment about heating food wasn't entirely facetious. The same technology behind an ordinary microwave oven was also present in the Herf, but reconfigured and focused along very different lines. As a less than lethal combat option, the Herf worked best as a deterrent device, temporarily subjecting its targets to a painful heat ray effect that even body armor couldn't attenuate. But against anything non-organic, The weapon's track record was unpredictable at best.
There!
Lucy shouted, and pointed to the south. The UCAV was starting in on its third pass, and from the angle of attack, it was clearly targeting the building they were standing on.
One.
Mark began to count, bracing himself to draw a bead on the prow of the drone as it turned inbound.
Two.
He put his finger on the trigger switch and took a deep breath.
And three.
There was no howl of tortured air, no showy bolt of energy that leapt from the dish muzzle of the gun. Instead, Mark became aware of a hazy lensing effect that blurred his vision and a deep, unpleasant oscillation inside the gun's casing.
What are you waiting for? Shoot!
Lucy shouted.
I have! I am!
He snapped back, holding the weapon steady, his aim never shifting from the Avenger's nose cone. It was still coming, swift and deadly. Mark kept the firing switch depressed, and past the count of 5 seconds a yellow light blinked on, warning him to release the button. He ignored it, continuing to 10 seconds, 12, 15. The yellow light turned red, and the Herf gun's humming grew loud and insistent.
What are you waiting for?
Demanded the Englishman. He prodded Teep in the shoulder. Blow
the building!
But Teep was shaking his head.
This isn't right.
He moved the mouse pointer, but the display on the main repeater screen had crashed. The tactical display frozen with the UCAV in a banking turn toward the point of missile release. Grunwald and Ellis crowded around the secondary video monitor, which showed the grey-on-grey blur of the hillside flashing past beneath the Avengers' fuselage.
No Hellfire launch, said the mercenary.
Looks like jamming, said Teep. Signal is breaking up. The drone isn't answering commands.
Stormline are cutting us out, said Grunwald. The Americans must have severed the link.
No, Teep shook his head. This is on site. We're losing.
He fell silent as all the screens linking the Santa Cruz directly to Argonaut 2 abruptly went dark. Tommy grabbed him by the shoulder.
Get it back, he snarled.
At 20 seconds, the Herf gun was uncomfortably hot, and the plastic casing was in danger of burning the skin off Mark's face. The UCAV seemed unaffected, its high-speed approach vector unchanged, but then it suddenly struck him how close the Avenger was to the walls of the compound. By now, it was well inside the optimal release envelope for the AGMs, but still, it hadn't fired. A whiff of acrid, burnt plastic stink filtered out of the Herf gun as he exceeded the experimental weapon's safety margin and the device abruptly went dead. He almost threw it down, the palms of his hands red raw from surface searing.
Look, Lucy pointed. Holy shit.
That actually worked. Mark saw the drone's nose dip as it passed over the outer wall, and the robot aircraft seemed to sag in midair, as if all the fight had gone out of it. Streamers of smoke issued out of the vents in the Avengers' fuselage where the drone had been coming straight at him, right into the apex of the Herf gun's invisible beam. The port wing rising in a too-late course correction, the drone went in toward the rubble-strewn road that led to the main building, and the starboard wingtip clipped the edge of a water tower. With a screech of twisting metal, the drone was flipped around. It dived at the ground and dashed itself against the dirt with a thunderous roar. An explosion flared orange-red, throwing the burning fuselage back up into the air, turning it into a tumbling mass of fire. A fleeting moment of elation at defeating the UCAV faded in Mark as he realized the wrecked machine was going to come crashing into the building.
Run!
He sprinted away from the edge of the roof, just as the burning drone struck, and a pair of Hellfires went off in the collision. One of the missiles was thrown free of the fireball and shot away into the sky on a wild trajectory, spiraling away into the mountainside miles distant. The other blew out the front quarter of the building and forced blazing drafts through the lower floor, turning everything into an inferno. Mark felt the sickening lurch as supports crumbled and the building shook, slumping in on itself. The entire roof structure dropped 2 meters beneath his feet, and great cracked sections of it tilted away behind him at sharp angles.
Mark stumbled to his knees and twisted in time to see Lucy lose her footing and drop. Her boots couldn't find purchase, and she skidded down the slope of the broken roof toward the fires below. He launched himself forward, snatching at her. Lucy's hand caught his sleeve and pulled hard, almost enough to drag him down with her. He fell flat, clinging to a section of air vent that showed something approaching stability, and for long, precarious seconds they both hung there.
Any time you're ready, he wheezed.
She used him like a climbing frame and pulled herself back from the edge before the two of them rolled back onto the creaking roof and lay there gasping for breath.
Okay, said Lucy, her throat raw with effort. Let's not do that again.
Stormline reports loss of signal from Argonaut 2.
Teep spoke in his usual monotone, his voice so bereft of effect it was almost robotic.
No confirmation on third weapon release.
They shut it down,
Ellis said, looking around the compartment at the blank screens.
How could that happen?
He looked at the Englishman.
This is the same punk from Etna. How is he capable of...
Tommy wasn't listening to him. He prodded Teep with a finger.
What did you do?
Not me, Teep replied. I just did what you said.
He pointed at the mouse.
Move the clicker where you wanted it.
The Englishman swore, and for a moment it looked like he was going to punch Teep out of anger, but then he turned away and his glare found Grunwald, who stood watching the interchange.
Why didn't you just put a bullet in that prick when you had him?
Ellis answered for him.
Because we were told to deal with this problem discreetly.
He nodded at the blank screens.
Although that directive seems to have gone out the window since you turned up.
The compound suffered a sustained missile bombardment, said the Swiss mercenary. There's no reason to assume the targets didn't perish.
No reason to assume they did, either, Tommy snarled back.
He threw up his hands.
Bollocks. All right.
We've done enough. Wasted too much time on this already. He shook his head.
The Yanks will be pissed off about losing their toy, so we can't let this connect back to the Combine.
He shot a look at Teep.
Close off the link to Stormline. Wipe all this and put it in a fucking box. Kadir's operation is where we're supposed to be at. We concentrate on him from now on. Stop wasting time and effort on distractions.
My thoughts, exactly, insisted Grunwald.
At last, the Englishman was starting to see things his way. Tommy closed the distance between them.
Find a local. Get them out to the orphanage to check the site. That'll put the lid on it.
Ellis sniffed.
Someone is still going to have to talk to the higher-ups, he said, fixing the Englishman with a sideways look. Don't envy you telling them you got no bodies.
The other man glanced at Grunwald, indicating Ellis.
How do you stand the sound of this twat's voice in your ear all the time? Tommy snorted.
Listen, Dane is dead or he's not, and if he's not, he's still an international fugitive on about 50 different terrorist watch lists. So either way, he's fucked.
Mark found a crate full of empty soda bottles and dragged it into the shade before using it as a makeshift stool. He glanced around the sparse village, the first sign of civilization he and Lucy had found after striking out from the burning compound. He thought to begin with that the building shading him from the setting sun was some kind of garage, and it clearly did perform that function, with an oily old Skoda up on blocks inside. But it also seemed to serve as a sort of general store and cafe for the settlement as well. Across the way from him, a group of older Turkish men sat around a card table in plastic lawn chairs, alternating between sipping from cups of coffee and giving him unfriendly stares. He managed a weak smile and saluted them with the ice lolly that Lucy had taken from the garage store's grumbling refrigerator. She handed a fold of $100 bills to the man in the mechanic's overalls who met them on their arrival, and in return he offered bottles of water and the cooling popsicles. Mark sucked on the orange-flavored ice and stared morosely into the distance. The two of them had barely made it off the crumbling roof, scrambling down a corroded fire escape before the building gave a final howling moan and collapsed. Coated in dust and soot,
they had little choice left but to abandon the compound and start walking. Lucy's smartphone had been lost in the drone attack, and Mark's was broken. He tried and failed to get a response from his laptop, wincing at the rattling that came from the device when he shook it. So they walked in tired silence, with the sun falling toward the horizon behind them. The roads returned such as they were, and Lucy spotted the nameless village as the hillside began to flatten out around them. Walking into the town proper set Mark thinking about a scene from a spaghetti western, as the two strangers were greeted with suspicion. Mark glanced at the men again and watched them talking about him. They had to have heard the drone, he thought, or at least the sounds of the explosions. And if this was the closest town to the New Day orphanage, these people had to know the men who worked there. Mark wondered how that would figure with him and Lucy. Was someone nearby already making a phone call, reporting back to an Al-Saif cell member or a Combine contact? He was tired, and some part of him was telling him to pack up and run. Fatigue seemed to be winning the argument, though. He sat on the crate, feeling every ache in his body, crunching the ice between his teeth until only the stick was left. Mark pulled the sliver of wood from his lips and studied it as Lucy emerged from the garage. "No joke," he said without thinking.
"See what?"
He showed her. "No joke, see? When I was a kid, they used to print gags on lolly sticks. Why did the chicken cross the road, that kind of thing."
"I know that one," she said, "because the poor feathered asshole was being chased by a drone."
Mark gave a shrug. "I suppose comedy is less funny when it's happening to you." He tossed the stick into the gutter. "You find a working telephone?" Lucy nodded.
"They got a landline. Put a message in the Rubicon dead drop. Now we wait."
She jerked her thumb at the floor above the garage.
"I rented us somewhere to crash. Cost us more than a night in the Ankara Hilton, but then I'm buying his silence."
She nodded at the coffee-drinking men, who had now been joined by the mechanic.
"Theirs, too. I would really like a shower," Mark noted. "You really need one," she replied with a nod. "But sadly, they can only spare enough water for one of us, so you're out of luck."
Mark hesitated, and before he could say more, Lucy went on, "And don't ask if we can share. I know we both got shot at and all, but that doesn't mean I'm going to sleep with you."
"I wasn't going to say that," he retorted. "Bloody hell."
Lucy sniggered, and he realized too late she'd been making fun of him.
"God, you Brits. You're so easy to troll."
"Hey," Mark sighed.
"You don't get to do sarcasm. You're an American. You people aren't supposed to understand irony. You'd be surprised."
She blew out a breath and fell silent for a long moment. When she spoke again, Lucy was staring off over the hillside.
"So that was a trap back there. Not just the grenade, I mean. The whole place. Your lead from MI6.
"Yeah." Admitting it felt like a weight settling on him. The Combine cleaned house, but they left the New Day info behind as a snare. I mean, I knew that was a possibility, but I never thought, I mean, a U.S. Navy UCAV. I did not see that coming, in both the literal and figurative senses.
"Look on the bright side," she said. "We just torched a few million dollars worth of taxpayers' money back there. Someone will have to carry the can for that. That's blowback the Combine won't like."
Mark scowled. "I'm going to flinch every time a plane passes over from now on.
Them's the breaks."
She yawned and worked a muscle in her shoulder.
"It's not a total bust, though. We're alive. We got new intel. That's a win of sorts."
"So we know that Al-Saif and the Combine were working some kind of angle out here," Mark said, thinking aloud. "Not a pleasant setup. Using a camp for war orphans as what? A weapons dump? Training facility?
Both?"
she offered. Mark nodded at the grim possibility. He still had no idea how the orphanage connected to the Palomino or the Barcelona bombing, but he couldn't escape the chilling certainty that those acts of terror had just been the opening shots. He thought about the horrors in the blood-stained basement, and his lip twisted in disgust.
"I get one thing now," said Lucy. "Solomon has been chasing this hard,
and that place is the reason why. The orphanage. She nodded. I think it's personal for him.
What do you mean?
Mark lowered his voice. Lucy was bringing him into a confidence.
You know what Rubicon is, but most people don't know where it grew from. Solomon was a war orphan himself. Family wiped out during the civil war in Mozambique. You've seen those pictures of kids in knockoff Nikes and soccer shorts carrying assault rifles. You go back 30 years.
She let the statement hang. Mark's eyes narrowed. He was a child soldier.
Think on that, said Lucy. And then, maybe, you get what he's about.
He nodded, taking it in. Is that why you fell in with Rubicon? Lucy's body language shifted immediately, and she leaned away from him, the brief moment of openness melting away.
I told you he offered me a deal, and working for someone who wants to do the right thing is good for my karma.
She looked out over the hillside.
What about you?
What about me? She turned back to study him.
How'd you end up a techie? I mean, you got skills, that's clear enough. You're kind of random, but I've seen worse in the field. How come you're not an agent?
Officer, he corrected. In Britain, we call them field officers, not agents. He knew Lucy was deliberately steering the conversation away from herself. But even as he saw that, he was already falling into old patterns of explanation and denial.
I didn't make the cut, he sighed, and the next words came from nowhere. I didn't want the risk.
The safer bet, huh?
I get that.
Her tone touched a raw nerve.
You really don't, he shot back. People don't get it.
Mark shook his head. It's not about courage or weakness or anything like that. It's about understanding yourself. I know my limitations. Suddenly he was on his feet, scowling at her, the memories of dark sea and thunderous sky at the edges of his thoughts.
I never asked for this. I never wanted any of it to happen. I went right to the ragged edge once, and that was enough for me. I don't want to be here.
And yet, you are, she said mildly, his anger rolling off her. Lucy stood up and turned to walk away.
Not dead yet, when by all rights you damn well should be.
What does that tell you, Dane?
Where's your limit now?